Good morning. I'm Bob Collins. I write the Newscut blog for Minnesota Public Radio, and I'm filling in today for Carrie Miller. I admit to being a person of a certain age, so the word cancer still packs a big wallop, a bigger wallop perhaps, owing to a day when it wasn't at all a cause for hope. But we know times have changed, science marches on, and yet when President Jimmy Carter announced last summer that he had cancer and that it had spread from his liver to his brain, the possibility never occurred to me that just a few months later he'd be announcing to his Sunday school class that he was cancer-free. Why exactly the president's cancer may have been defeated is still not entirely clear, at least to me, but the fact he was receiving immunotherapy got a lot of us to sit up and take notice. The idea of cueing the immune system to come alive and attack cancerous cells and tumors is one of the most exciting fronts in the fight against cancer. It's always, though, easy to get ahead of ourselves when the subject is cancer and when there's a success story to talk about. So we have called upon two people to join us today and help us sort through what's going on here with cancer research and treatment, and we want to take your questions on the subject, too. Dr. Roxana Adranka is an oncologist at Mayo Clinic in Rochester. She was the primary investigator on the clinical trial of the drug Keytrude that was used in treating President Carter. She joins us this morning from Rochester. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning.
Dr. Christopher Pinnell is a professor in the Microbiology, Immunology, and Cancer Biology program over at the University of Minnesota, where his team is developing and trying to develop DNA vaccines to treat human cancer. And he joins me in the studio this morning. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
I know you've got questions, and we're here to answer them as best we can. Kindly give us a call at 651-227-6000 or toll-free at 800-242-2828. You can also comment online at nprnews.org/live. Have you had experience with immunotherapy? Has your doctor talked to you about it? Did the news of the president's treatment cause you to talk to your doctor about it? Give us a call or send us a message, and we'd like to hear from you. Dr. Dranka, let's start with you. Were you surprised when you heard about President Carter's experience, or was the media more or less overreacting to a known reality? Was there an actual breakthrough here?
Good morning. Yes, I was not entirely surprised. I actually have seen the successes in the clinic. As you mentioned, I have been the Mayo Clinic primary principal investigator for the drug Keytruda for the earlier clinical trials in metastatic melanoma that led to its FDA approval. I was surprised then in 2010 and 2011 when I saw my first few patients with metastatic melanoma have their cancer shrink significantly and in some cases actually go into what we call complete remission. We always are very cautious in, situations like this in metastatic cancer to call it a remission. But I have seen patients for whom this remission have now lasted years. I have a few patients that are now 4 or 5 years out with no signs of the cancer coming back. So I was surprised then. I am still surprised now and very happy, but I'm learning to accept this as a new reality and hopefully as a new breakthrough for cancer therapy.
Chris, explain to me how, in general, how immunotherapy works. There are several flavors of it, as I understand.
Yeah. To answer that, do you mind if I spend about Please. 2 minutes on Immunology 101?
Okay, sure.
Because to put
as long as we get our 3 credits for it.
So the immune system functions to maintain balance or homeostasis in the body. When that balance is perturbed by injury, infection, or disease, the immune system becomes activated. And in the early years of immunology, we were all focused on how this activation occurs. But it's only been within the last 20 years that we've really focused on how it's suppressed. Because if you don't suppress it, it can lead to harmful sequelae like autoimmune disease and damage to the body. So, friendly fire, if you will. Mm-hmm. So it's this turning off of the immune system that has really led to the breakthroughs that Roxana just mentioned. And tumors have subverted the normal way that the immune system turns itself off to turn off the immune cells that are in the tumor that could potentially attack it. So what we've learned to do as a field is we've been able to interrupt the ability of the tumor to turn off the immune system.
So the key, what I described as turning on or waking up the immune system to make an attack is more being able to turn it off before it does some damage.
Right. So for an immune system to function properly, it has to be turned on, and then it ramps up. And then when the causative agent of the immune response, the infection or the injury, is then handled and it's cleared, then the immune system has to go back down and turn itself off. And this is an exquisitely orchestrated series of events that has an on and an off switch at both ends, but a rheostat in the middle to control the intensity of the response. And what some viruses have done and what some tumors have done is they've evolved to take advantage of the body's own way of turning off the immune system to turn it off for their own advantage.
Mm-hmm. When you hear President Carter's story, and I know you're not doing research on the drug that was employed
right
there, but does that give you a little pep in your step when you go off to work in the morning?
Yeah, I feel like $1 million. It's outstanding. I mean, I just deal with mice. So when the mice live, I jump up and down, but nobody else cares.
Because the mice live.
Right. Yeah. But when you see someone survive, it's outstanding. And John Kersey, who was unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago, was the founding director of the Cancer Center at the University of Minnesota. And when we had his retirement party, the patient that he treated, John was the first person in the world to do a bone marrow transplant for a child with lymphoma. And this child was there who is now 45 with his children. And if that didn't bring a tear to your mm-hmm. eye, nothing would. And that was an early form of immunotherapy.
Dr. Dranka, what's been the response since the president's announcement or the announcement about the president? When I hear that someone's cancer is gone, in quotation marks, you start thinking cure for cancer. I assume we're getting a little ahead of ourselves.
We may be, but, not entirely. The response was fantastic, in the media. And, patients are very well educated and they have learned a lot about this. And as physicians, we know that this can happen. 1 in 10 patients can have what we call a complete remission or a complete response with these new immunotherapy drugs. And a lot of other patients can have their tumor either shrink or stabilize over time. Now the community, the medical community, is trying to go one step ahead and build upon the successes, and we are trying to find new ways to prolong these responses and actually increase the number of patients that could benefit from these drugs. We know these drugs do not work for everyone. They work for some patients. We are working very hard to understand who are those patients that can benefit from these drugs, and how can we increase the number of patients? How can we expand this to other tumor types besides melanoma? We know these drugs are now approved for lung cancer and kidney cancer, and hopefully they will be approved for other diseases. There have been successes in patients with bladder cancer. So we are trying to expand this to more patients, to more tumor types. We are trying to build upon these drugs to combine them with vaccines or with other types of immunotherapy drugs, with chemotherapy drugs, with drugs that are focused against certain genetic changes in the tumor, in the hope that we can prolong the responses and prolong the complete responses and ultimately cure cancer.
You mentioned vaccines, and Dr. Pinnell, that's in your wheelhouse, isn't it?
Yeah, so yes. So the way that vaccines – so let me just step back. Mm-hmm. The way that I view an immune response against a tumor, and this will get to your question mm-hmm. in a minute,
take your time,
is that you can think of a wall, and on one side of the wall is the tumor, and on the other side of the wall is the immune system. Without the wall, the immune system could go in and destroy the tumor. The wall is erected, if you will, by the tumor itself and the microenvironment in which it finds itself. And so there are two ways then that you can think of getting those immune cells to the tumor through this wall. One is to lower the height of the wall. Mm-hmm. The other is to basically make a tsunami such that you get this overwhelming response of the immune system that it goes over the wall and crashes into the tumor. Vaccines are the latter approach, where you try to get a large number of immune cells that can attack the tumor and just get a mass action effect where they swamp out whatever suppressive molecules and cells the tumor can bring to bear. The type of therapy that President Carter had lowers that wall. So what Roxana was just alluding to with these combination therapies is if you can lower the wall and increase the response, we hope we can get something better to work. And so these sorts of combination therapies are where the field is heading, but you've got to try them, each of the components individually, to make sure that there are no unexpected toxicities or problems mm-hmm. with them before you start putting them together.
And when we talk about vaccines, because when I hear vaccines, I think of something you take to prevent something from happening. We're talking actually targeting an existing
problem. Yeah, so there are two types of vaccines, prophylactic, which prevents mm-hmm. a disease, and therapeutic, which cures a disease that's already in place.
That's Dr. Christopher Pennell. We're also talking with Dr. Roxana Dronka, and we want to hear from you at 651-227-6000 or toll-free 800-242-2828. Let's take a couple of phone calls. Let's go to Andy and Savage. Good morning, Andy.
Yeah, hi there. I guess I was just curious about what types of cancers this treatment has been approved for and has been successful on. In particular, my uncle just learned that he has prostate cancer, stage 3, I believe, and was just wondering if this might be something that would be a possible treatment for his situation.
And you mean with the Keytrude, this drug we've been talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. Dr. Dronka?
Sure. So Keytruda and a similar drug on the market called Opdivo are both anti-PD-1 agents. These type of agents have now been approved for metastatic melanoma, for metastatic lung cancer, and also for recently for metastatic kidney cancer. They have not yet been approved for prostate cancer or other types of cancers. There is an active field of research in other tumor types. I have mentioned bladder cancer because I think the clinical studies are a little bit more far ahead in this tumor type with a similar agent called an anti-PD-L1 agent. For prostate cancer, initial studies have not been as encouraging as we have hoped with single agent or with this type of immunotherapy alone. And the research is now focused on trying to combine this type of agents with either targeted radiotherapy for prostate cancer or with targeted hormonal treatments. So hopefully that will help create a little bit of an opportunity for prostate cancer as well.
All right. Let's go to Abby in Minnetonka. I'm not sure which. Abby?
Yes, this is Abby.
Abby, okay, thank you.
It's ABI. I'm in Minnetonka. I was going to ask, when you talk about immune system, my son, 11 years ago, had brain tumor and then got post-treatment lymphoma and MDS and got a bone marrow transplant and a second bone marrow transplant after 5 years, and it failed. He passed in October 20th, just this year. My question is regarding his MDS turned into AML leukemia, and the Mayo Clinic was one of the clinics that we consulted. I just wanted to see if there are programs on immunotherapy as well as T cell therapy that they are trying in MD Anderson and CHOP. If you are doing anything at the university here or Mayo Clinic for AML leukemia, and how do you see the outlook for AML leukemia?
All right. Well, let's have Chris handle that one first.
Yes, the therapy to which you alluded, Abby, is called CAR, chimeric antigen receptor therapy. And this is a way to genetically reprogram a patient's own white blood cells to attack the tumor. And so what we do, and this is being done at the University of Minnesota, for childhood acute lymphoblastic leukemia, I don't think we're doing AML in the clinic, but we're certainly looking at it in the laboratory. And the way that this strategy works is that you take a patient's white blood cells out, you introduce a gene that encodes a molecule that allows all of those white blood cells to find an attack to attack the tumor, and then you put in billions of those cells back into the patient, and then they can systemically distribute throughout the body and hopefully kill all of the tumor cells. The advantage to this approach is that typically the immune system is trying to find a needle in the haystack, where only one in hundreds of billions of cells may be specific for the tumor that you have. So it's a numbers game that you can't win if you've got one versus billions. But if you can take out white blood cells and make them all specific for the tumor, now you've increased the frequency from one in a billion to one in a hundred. And now you've got the numbers that you can used to successfully eradicate the tumor. And those sorts of strategies at CHOP and at MD Anderson and at Memorial Sloan Kettering have had phenomenal success rates in pediatric malignancies like acute lymphoblastic leukemia, where 90% of the children are long-term in long-term complete remission, where otherwise they would have been dead. For AML, we're trying to do that, but the problem is the key question in the field is, what are you going to train those cells to attack? And for some tumors, it's an easier question to answer than for others.
This is the part of your business, I guess, that fascinates me, because you have to be incredibly patient to be a researcher here.
Yep.
Baby steps almost seems like too big of a word, or too big of a metaphor, I guess.
Yeah, you have to be incredibly patient. And my father was amazed I went into this field, because I was not a patient child.
Yeah.
But the payoff is worth it. So 95% of the time, at least in my hands, it doesn't work. Yeah. But that 5% of the time when it does is just enough to carry you through. And it's just phenomenally exciting. If you can find something that nobody else knows, and you're the only person in the world that you think knows it for a little period of time anyway, I mean, it's an exhilaration that is indescribable.
Yeah.
And the field is just so exciting, and it's so it moves so quickly that it's fascinating, and it's fascinating.
Dr. Dranka, on a personal level, how does this fit in? I mean, are you a patient person? What are we talking about as you do your research? What would be a good day for you in your business?
Well, I guess I have to agree. I'm not the most patient person in real life, but I learned that I actually can, I don't know how, can be a patient in research and in clinic. I have been very fortunate to be at the Mayo Clinic, where I treat patients in the clinic, and then I also have opportunities to participate in research. I have amazing mentors here that have guided me through ever since I started training, I get to work with people in the field, giants in the field that have that we collaborate, and we do amazing work. So a perfect day would be where our team comes up with a strategy or with a clinical trial or with an idea for research, and then we test it in the clinic, and we see that our patients can benefit, and we help patients live longer or live better because of this research. And I think that, like Dr. Pennell said, that carries you through and makes your day and makes your year, and you want to continue doing that.
When you come up with an idea and a theory to test, how long is it typically before you can say, eureka, or gee, that didn't work, let's try something else? And how many let's try something else's are there for every eureka?
Quite a few. And usually it takes months. In the best case scenario, it can take years. That is why when we talk about being patient, truly you have to be patient. Sometimes there are ideas that are born, and then 2 or 3 or 4 years later, we see the first results of this research, or we understand where this should go to be successful. And there are many attempts for each success, there are many failures, I guess. And one thing that you have to learn is you have to accept failure. And because you cannot have all these eurekas without a lot of attempts and a lot of trying a lot of things.
Yeah. Back to President Carter for a second, and Keytruda in particular. As I understand it, there were several different therapies that were used here, including chemo. How do we know that the Keytruda was the one that made the difference? Or do we know that Keytruda was the one that made the difference?
Well, as you said, I wasn't involved in his care. So from what I understand as well, there have been different types of therapies for his cancer that was metastatic to the brain and the liver. We probably won't know for sure which agent has contributed to what, or what is responsible for the success. However, we do know that in the past, with the treatments that we had available, with chemotherapies or targeted therapies to the brain, the successes would be short-lived. So based on our experience in the past, if we see that the response is carried through and he continues to be in remission for a long time, we can attribute part of the success to the immunotherapy, because we know this is an added treatment to what we've had in the past.
I know since he was a president that Jimmy Carter is a different person, really, than the rest of us. But he's 91. Does that factor in the calculus that you have to make, which I can imagine is an excruciating one, on when to try a certain immunotherapy with somebody, at least in a research setting? Dr. Dronka.
That's a great question. And for a lot of treatments, sometimes, not necessarily the age, I would say, but a person's medical, what we say, comorbidities or other illnesses or their organ functions, that we need to be very, very careful. You don't want to make the treatment worse than the disease. So we have to take everything into consideration. It's not necessarily an age-related factor, I would say. We've been very fortunate with this type of immunotherapies, the kind of the second generation immunotherapies, drugs such as Keytruda. We found that they are pretty well tolerated. The risks of what we call collateral damage or turning the immune system against oneself are low, not zero, but fairly low, and we have learned to manage these side effects fairly successfully. So I would say if someone is healthy and has no other contraindications to receive the drug, we routinely do the same thing in the clinic.
Bo from Mankato called and asks, do the doctors look at the gene sequence of the cancer cells to see if they respond to treatment? Dr. Pennell?
Yeah, that's the way the field is going. So when cancer therapy started, actually it was derived from the mustard gases that were used in World War I. Those gases and the chemicals damage DNA to the point of no... So the cell's DNA is damaged beyond the point of repair, and the cell kills itself. So that's chemotherapy. It was actually based on those sorts of studies back in World War I, shortly thereafter. So chemotherapy kills rapidly dividing cells. But it doesn't distinguish between normal cells and that are rapidly dividing, such as your hair follicle cells, cells in your blood, and malignant cells that are rapidly dividing. So that's where you get the toxicity. So then the field thought, we need to make a more targeted sort of therapy. So the way I think about the evolution of cancer therapy is a bullseye. It's a target. Mm-hmm. The outer ring is chemotherapy or standard radiation therapy. Then an inner ring is tumor-based therapies, where if you have a particular tumor, a particular drug will work. And then the center circle of that bullseye is patient-specific therapy. And there you can take, for example, a biopsy of a tumor, sequence the DNA, take normal cells from the same individual, sequence that DNA, and see what's different about the tumor with respect to the normal cells. And if those mutations are in a pathway for which you have a drug, then you can say, okay, that patient is going to respond to drug A.
How long does that take to do?
To do the sequencing, yeah. It's on the order of a week or so.
Oh, amazing.
It is. It's phenomenal. And the cost, when the human genome was first sequenced, it was about $100 million. Now it's less than $1,000.
Unbelievable.
So the technology is phenomenal. The other, but germane to the question, is that you can also predict, based on the normal genes that a person expresses, whether or not they can handle a particular drug. And so if you can handle the drug, then maybe you can get more of it. Or if you can't metabolize it and it's going to be toxic, you may not get it. Or tumors with a certain mutation may not respond to a particular drug. So then why subject the patient to the nonspecific toxicities of that drug if it's not going to have any effect on the tumor? Mm-hmm. So this is a way that we're focusing in on cancer. It was initially basically cancer, rapidly dividing cells, then tumor-specific, and now it's patient-specific.
Melanie in Bloomington has called us. I think her call is for Dr. Dronka. Melanie?
Yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Thanks for taking my call. My husband had an immunotherapy IL-2 the end of 2011. I was wondering how is that, which is a really, really invasive therapy, but how is that different than this Keytruda or Opdivo that you've been talking about?
Yes, very, very good question. IL-2 is kind of one of the first immunotherapy drugs that were used and actually approved back in the 70s for melanoma and also for kidney cancer. Is an immune, it activates the immune system, but it does so in a more non-specific way. And that is why what you've said is very true. It is a invasive and aggressive therapy because a lot of immune cells are activated. They are, some of them are directed against the cancer to try and kill it, but some of them are just activated and then they'll go on and attack normal cells and normal organs in the body. The drugs such as Keytruda and the earlier drug ipilimumab, those are more specific therapies, and they activate the population, or hopefully the population of the immune cells that are more directed against the tumor rather than all the immune cells in the body. We've learned that especially Keytruda and so the anti-PD-1 therapies are more specific, directed against those particular T cells that are designed to fight the cancer, and therefore what we call the collateral damage or the autoimmune side effects are definitely much less than with drugs such as interleukin-2 or IL-2 or the earlier drug interferon.
Chris?
Yeah, this relates to the point that I made earlier about activating and suppressing the immune system. So IL-2, as Roxana just mentioned, is it's a broadly immune-activating molecule. But the immune system has evolved to make that at high concentrations locally, at really only the spot at which the immune system is called to action. When IL-2 is given to a cancer patient, it's delivered systemically, so it's the whole body's washed in this. So you're getting all of this activation of these cells in areas where it's not going to do any good, it's going to do damage. And so the hope is that some of that activation will lead to tumor-specific T cells that will kill the tumor, but you're getting 99, you know, I was saying like maybe 10 in a billion are active, or what you want. Well, all those other cells are being activated as well in a way that is not physiological.
We heard from Marilyn, who sent us a note online. She says, I am getting injections of my white blood cells and a peptide for ovarian cancer in a trial at the Mayo Clinic. And she says, I am 1 year into the trial and am cancer-free. Which leads me to this question, and that is, at what speed are we making progress here? The only speedometer a lot of us have who aren't researchers or in the business is the people we know who are getting cancer and in many cases dying of cancer. The obituary page is full of notations about someone dying after a brave fight with cancer, and it often looks like we're not plodding along very quickly. But are we, or are we not?
I think we are, but there are limitations that are imposed because we don't want to do any harm. So if I come up with a breakthrough eureka moment in my laboratory and come up with something that works better than anything I've ever seen, at that point, from the time that is discovered, and I'm convinced that this is the best thing that I've ever seen in my life, from that time to the time it becomes available in the clinic is about 10 years. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say in the clinic, but by the time the FDA would approve it, it's about a decade, because then it has to go through a variety of clinical trials. And so if I have something that I think is better than the current gold standard of treatment for a particular cancer, I have to prove that in the clinical setting. And that has to go through three phases typically of clinical trials. It costs about $1 billion, so it's not something that we can do at the academic level, so we have to pair with industry. Industry doesn't want to pair with you unless you have patents, so there's a lot of legal, you know, ramifications and everything like that. So that's why it takes roughly a decade and roughly $1 billion to get something from the laboratory to a first-line drug. And so the PD-1 and PD-L1 and anti-CTLA-4 and all of these checkpoint inhibitors we knew about in the lab 15 years ago. But it's only now becoming accepted in the clinic because it's taken that long to show that these are better than the pre-existing gold standards.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Drunk, I'm not sure how long you've been an oncologist, but do you sit back from time to time and think, well we've really come an incredibly long way, or not?
Yes, I think we have come a long way. I started my training at the Mayo Clinic in oncology in 2007. I was interested in melanoma from the get-go, and at that time we had a couple of drugs that worked sometimes, very rarely, and we did not have a lot of things to offer. Since in the last few 5 years or so, we have had 8 new drugs approved for metastatic melanoma, immunotherapy, targeted therapies. So I think we have, at least in my field, we have come a long way. In other tumor types, I see every day or like every week, you know, something is announced, either a clinical trial that has successful results or an FDA drug that was approved. So I think a lot of the research that we have done earlier is paying off. The field has advanced incredibly on multiple fronts. So it's not only immunotherapy that's a breakthrough nowadays, as Dr. Pinnell has mentioned, tumor-targeted therapies, the genetic therapies, and now the individual and the patient-directed therapies. So I think the field is moving fast. Indeed, we are constrained by having to prove the safety and having to test all these drugs in clinical trials to make sure that we don't harm our patients. But I think we're moving a little bit faster than we did before, and we have a lot more tools at our disposal nowadays with the advances in science.
When you have a patient and you have a treatment that you think has a pretty good shot at working, but then it doesn't work, do you know why it doesn't work? And do you learn something there, or does it take a longer period of time than that to figure it out?
Most often, we don't know why it doesn't work. You know, if we knew ahead of time, we probably would not offer to those patients. So I think that is an incredibly important question. And yes, we do learn. As I mentioned, I have teamed up with researchers at Mayo Clinic, Dr. Haidong Dong, who was one of the first that described the PD-L1 on tumors back in 1999. We have asked the same question. You know, why are some of my patients responding so beautifully and for a long time, and why are some patients not responding? So we have started research to try to understand if there are certain markers on the tumor, but now we're also focusing on certain markers on the immune cells in the blood that could predict ahead of time which patients are most likely to benefit from these drugs, and also to monitor during treatment the responses to this therapy, because sometimes the scans may be unreliable. The tumor may look like it's growing, but if you continue the drug, it actually will shrink in time. So we have published our research, and we are trying to bring this forward to try and develop more markers to help us understand who's going to benefit.
I'd like to put in a plug for basic research, Bob.
Okay.
So all of the breakthroughs that we're talking about were predicated on the success of basic immunologists. So Jim Allison, about 20 years ago, asked, how does an immune response get turned off? We know it has to be turned off. And he identified what's called the grandfather of all of these immune checkpoints, CTLA-4. But he didn't set out to develop a novel cancer therapy. He was asking a basic fundamental question in immunology: how do you turn off an immune system? And so all of these therapies are based on those sorts of questions that are being asked. And at the University of Minnesota, we have, and I'm not bragging because I'm part of it, but we have one of the best centers for immunologies in the world. It's ranked up in the top 20 or so. The immune system, to become activated, needs to get 3 signals. Signals 2 and 3 were identified by people in our group. Mm-hmm. And so without that understanding, all of these breakthroughs wouldn't be possible.
Go ahead.
No, and so yeah. so that's why it's critically important to have an integrated system like the Masonic Cancer Center at the University of Minnesota, where we integrate basic research. How does the immune system respond, and how is it turned off? That's a basic question in immunology. Then a translational research question is, how do we take that information and use it to treat a disease like cancer? And then the clinical research asks, how does this new emerging therapy, checkpoint blockade, compare to the current gold standard in the field for treating acute myeloid leukemia? And so it's this transition from basic to translational to clinical research that is what's necessary for these breakthroughs to occur. And as I mentioned before, basic researchers in the field knew about this 15 years ago, but it's taken this amount of time for it to become, you know, apparent to everybody. And the there's a magazine called Science. It's kind of like our People magazine. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, People has the sexiest man of the year. So David Beckham was the sexiest man of the year.
I like where this is going.
2 years ago, cancer immunotherapy was the sexiest breakthrough of the year.
All right.
Because of these checkpoint blockades and this T-cell genetically engineered therapy that I mentioned. So we're gaining national prominence, but it's really only because of basic immunology research.
Do you suppose that there is somebody else out there who is doing the same thing you're doing that you don't know about?
Yes.
And is that a problem that there isn't more? I don't know how it would work.
Well, of course, it's a problem when you read about it and you haven't published it. But there's an enormous amount of collaboration. There's competition. I mean, we're scientists. Everybody's competitive to some extent. There are some egos involved. But I think the thing that amazes me, especially here at the U, is the amount of collaboration and collegiality that goes on. So we're not internally competitive really at all. We're externally competitive. Mm-hmm. But that's the way the field goes. So if you and I are working on the same thing and I know you're really close by hearing through the grapevine that I'm going to be in the lab 20 hours a day to try to beat you to it. And so that may not help me and my family, but it has a bigger impact.
Dr. Dronka, are you going to go to the lab more to beat whoever else is working on Keytrude?
Well, I agree that there is, competition is healthy. We try to, be at the forefront and do research and publish it. And like Dr. Pinnell mentioned, there is a great amount of collaboration in the institution. The same thing happened here at Mayo. We do work what it's now called the team science. So I have collaborators from the basic research to, clinical collaborators. So we are trying to advance our research and definitely publish it as quickly as possible and announce it to the world so other people can try and reproduce and benefit from this research. If somebody publishes, before you, well, it's a disappointment. But if it's a good idea and if it's a good research, it always goes to the next step and the next step. So you can always, bring it and advance it forward. So I think competition is healthy in science as well.
When you read something that's been published that advances the research, do you have to go back and prove that that's true, or can you just jump ahead and then kind of leapfrog and start from where that research that was published leaves you? Does that make sense at all, Dr. Dronka?
Sure. It depends. Sometimes you do want to reproduce if, you're not sure or if it's a small study or if it's a very novel thing, if it's a new antibody or something that no one has published before. Definitely to be a sound science, it has to be reproducible by other people. That is why we are required in all the publications to detail our methods and everything that we've used for the research. In some other cases, you may not necessarily have to reproduce. You can take it and advance it forward and, like you said, leapfrog, and go with the idea or go to the next step.
Online, Evelyn in the Twin Cities, how can this immunotherapy be compared with Iskador, I think it is, or mistletoe therapy that is being widely used in Europe? I'm not sure if either one of you can handle that or has heard of that. But let's Dr. Dronka, does that ring a bell?
Not necessarily. I don't know what I know. A lot of some drugs in Europe may not necessarily be approved in U.S. or some research may be going on in Europe that we do not participate in the United States. These immunotherapy drugs, however, the anti-PD-1 and anti-PD-L1 drugs, the clinical trials are actually worldwide. We do have many centers in Europe, in Australia, participating, and we work with our collaborators from Europe to enroll patients and to publish this research. So these immunotherapy drugs, I think, are now approved, some of them in Europe as well, and the research is very active there as well. I'm not really sure about the mistletoe therapy and what it is used for.
Well, Dr. Dronka, thanks for being with us today. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Dr. Pennell, thank you for taking the time and coming in today.
Thank you. And I just wanted to mention that the Academic Health Center at the University of Minnesota is holding a mini medical school on cancer. It runs every Monday through March and the first Monday in April in the evenings. More information can be found on the University of Minnesota Academic Health Center website. So if your listeners have an interest in cancer, you'll be hearing from some of the top people.
Wonderful. Dr. Christopher Pennell is a professor in the Microbiology, Immunology, and Cancer Biology program at the University of Minnesota, where his team has been developing DNA vaccines to treat human cancer. Dr. Roxana Dronka is an oncologist at Mayo Clinic in Rochester. She was the primary investigator on the clinical trial of the drug Keytrude, which was used in treating President Carter in a separate treatment. Thanks for being with us again. Let's take a break, get an update on news. Here's Phil Picardi.